this formula, kt times is equal to h bar times a over c, where this is the acceleration. Of the observer. Now, when you what's the acceleration when you use for A the acceleration of the black hole? At the Schwarzschild radius, which is given by RS GM over C squared, M is the mass of the black hole. Then you find that KT is equal to given, I never can remember the powers of C, that's why I have to look at my notes here, H bar C cubed by GM. Yeah, that's right. So this is orders of magnitude discussion. So this is just in order to recall, to make this all these things plausible to you. We'll become more precise in a second. Here's also a different way of, so this is the temperature of the black hole. And if you say that the entropy of the black hole is something like E by KT, and the energy of the black hole is mc squared, then you derive that up to factors of order unity, this is indeed given by the area of the black hole divided by Lp squared. And the area of the black hole is given by 4 pi times the Schwarzschild radius. And the precise coefficient that was derived by Hawking is actually S is equal to the area of the event horizon divided by 4 times Lp squared. Okay. There are many, many problems with this, with these things. Because, for example, there's this blue shift problem, which is the following: you're sitting at somewhere very far away from the black hole, and you observe, the Planck spectrum of radiation. So this Planck spectrum has a peak at h bar omega given by h bar over times c over the Schwarzschild radius. This is the peak of the Planck spectrum. And this is what you should observe at far away from the black hole. Now, in order that such a photon of this energy is observed far away from the black hole, it has to climb out of the potential of the black hole and loses energy, right? So in case that the photon was somehow created, if this picture is at all applicable, if this photon was created somewhere close to the event horizon, then one can calculate that the amount of energy that it has lost is getting very, very close to infinity. But such a high energetic photon should be treated by the methods of quantum gravity. So there's an intrinsic feeling that something about this calculation may be not completely correct. So this is the blue shift problem. So is Hawking's Hawking's calculation valid? And I will have nothing to say about this here. What I want to address is the other problem, which is what is the microscopic explanation of the entropy. For example, Gerhard Toft has said, the entropy might be, entropy has something to do with information or loss of information. So he was thinking, okay, maybe the surface of the horizon is composed of little triangles or whatever, some small structures. And each of these small structures carries one bit of information. And then, if that's the case, then and what you have to assume is that each of these triangles has an area, let's say c times L p squared, where c is a constant, which we will determine in a second, and n times c L p squared, the number of triangles times the area of each triangle, should be the same as the area of the horizon. And if it's true that each of these triangles carries one bit of information, then the entropy is the same as sum over log the number of configuration. What's the number of configuration? Well, it's 2 to the power of n, right? If there's one bit of information. And that's log 2 by n. So in order that this is given by the area of the horizon times 4 lp squared, you find this constant here. And this kind of consideration also have given rise to the holographic principle and stuff like this. But I will also not talk about this. Just to say that people like Toft have thought about this problem, and they have made this heuristic, they gave this heuristic explanation that maybe there are some small structure on the event horizon, and some bit of information encoded in this small structure such that this entropy can be explained. So now we want to give a derivation, kind of derivation of this explanation from loop quantum gravity. So in order to do this precisely, I think I need at least two or three lectures, and to introduce the notion of isolated horizons. And of course, I don't have time for this, but I will just briefly mention this. What's an isolated horizon? So we have this picture that you have seen many times in textbooks on GR. So this is one of Penrose's conformal diagrams. So this is sky plus, I naught. And well, we consider a globally hyperbolic space-time. So we have space-like hypersurfaces. This is the black hole region here. And I don't know. So we as an isolated horizon is something like a black hole in equilibrium. So there's no radiation falling inside the black hole for some period of time, which is bounded by these two hypersurfaces, sigma naught and sigma one here. And in between, there's moments of time, that is other hypersurfaces, and the intersection of one of these hypersurfaces, sigma, with this null manifold here, because this has a null generator. This is the kind of event horizon here. Well, it's called an isolated horizon. So the whole thing here is called from here to here. This is a three-dimensional manifold. This is a two-dimensional manifold. This whole thing is called delta. This is the isolated horizon. And the intersection of the isolated horizon with sigma is the would-be event horizon, I mean the surface. And one of the assumptions is that H is SS2 topology in the simplest situation. And some bunch of other properties, which I will not mention here. So in order to make this precise, one has to invoke classical general relativity, in particular ratio 2's equation. One also has to use, in fact, very surprisingly, quantum Chern-Simons theory. Quantum Chern-Simons theory. And loop quantum gravity. And these three things actually nicely fit and give a consistent picture. So I will not do this. I will give you just the upshot. And the upshot is the following. So we have the following situation. We have this this H here. And what will happen is that there will be spin network functions intersecting this surface like this. And in general, for each puncture of the spin network function with the surface, there may be several edges coming in these punctures. There may also single ones. And of course, outside this thing, they may intersect and define a very complicated graph in general, like this maybe. So let me call this P1, P2, Pn. So we have n punctures. And on these edges, there are spin labels, right? So J, J1, 1, J1, 2, until J1, N1, here, J2, 1, and so on, until J2, N2, and so on. And we saw in the discussion of the area operator that one can diagonalize the area operator if one considers linear combinations of spin network functions such that these individual spins of edges which intersect the surface, they are labeled by the total angular momentum of these individual spins. So suppose that jk 1 and so on until jk nk couple to total angular momentum. angular momentum jk, then the spectrum or the eigenvalue of the area operator is 8 pi g h bar times the sum over punctures 1 to n jk times jk plus 1. And then there's this famous or infamous Emirzi parameter also. Which I think I forgot last time, but that it's sitting there. So now one has to decide about the following thing. What we want to do is we want to count states in the Hilbert space which give which are such that the eigenvalue of the area operator lies in a certain interval. So we have to decide which kind of states we want to distinguish from each other. So for example, if I would not count this total angular momentum, I would count the individual ones, all possible configurations that give jk, then certainly it's possible, certainly the entropy would be infinite. So this is not what you should do. And the physical intuition behind this is that this total angular momentum is something intrinsic to the surface, while these individual spins somehow are bulk degrees of freedom. So we want to trace over the bulk degrees of freedom and get thereby some kind of entropy or density matrix. So that's the physical reason behind this. Then if you consider spin network functions intersecting in certain punctures, then of course, from the kinematical Hilbert space point of view, for the same number of punctures, there are still an infinite number of states with the same area eigenvalue because diffeomorphisms, for example, can shift these punctures all over the surface. So we don't want that. So we have to go to the physical Hilbert space, which also takes this diffeomorphism invariance into account. So that's this point. So we have now only the question of the number of punctures and whether these punctures can be distinguished or should be counted as not distinguishable. And this is answered by the requirement of gauge invariance. So there is also some surface degrees of freedom here, and this comes in. This has something to do with this Chern-Simons theory, which prevent you from interchanging P1 and P2, say, or P1 and P3. So all the punctures have to be counted as distinguishable. So I said also once that the error operator corresponding to the black hole event horizon is a Dirac observer. This is due to the fact that one of these in this list of conditions that define an isolated horizon, it's automatically true that the Hamiltonian constraint vanishes at the boundary. So this black hole error is actually a Dirac observer. So if you take all this together, then the counting problem is the following. What we have is a number of punctures. Which are distinguishable. And we want to count number of states with eigenvalue lambda in some interval A naught minus LP squared, A naught plus LP squared. This is the number of states you want to count. And A naught is some large area. Large because we want to describe big black holes, for which a semi-classical treatment like this one is valid, because here we are using classical relativity in order to set up the situation. So that's a self-consistent assumption. So okay, let's do that. And then one piece of information that I have to give you in order to understand the calculation is the fact that okay, if you have a total angular momentum jk at this kth puncture, then the magnetic quantum number can take values in the interval minus, or in the set of numbers minus jk, minus jk plus 1, and so on until jk. And these are 2 jk plus 1 numbers. And for a reason that I cannot properly explain without going into more details, these are counted also as different degrees of freedom. So what you want to count is a number of punctures, and then states which are such that this value lies in this interval, and then you take all possible values of these magnetic quantum numbers and you count the number of states. So let me give an example to see how this works. And there's one additional constraint, which is that sum over all k, mk is equal to 0. And this is some. This comes from gauge invariance, SU2 gauge invariance. So the story is more complicated than I will give it to you here. But this counting problem can be set up in this way. So let's take an example. Suppose that all jk are equal to 1/2. So this would correspond to Toft's assumption, because then, of course, there are two possible degrees of freedom per puncture. So 2 jk plus 1 is 2 in this case. Now, if we want to satisfy this condition, then there must be n half spins must be up, and n half spins must be down. And the eigenvalue of the error operator is given by 8 pi g h bar times the number of punctures times square root of jk times jk plus 1, which in this case should be square root of 3 over 2. So this should be a naught. So you can solve for n in terms of a naught. And now we need to count the possible distribution of spins on these n punctures, and they can be up or down, modulo the constraint that this has to be happen. So it's not difficult to see that the number of configurations is given by n over 2, n choose n over 2. And the entropy is the logarithm of this. And if you do this properly, then you use Stirling's formula in order to evaluate the factorials here, and you get you get some beta naught times, or 1 over beta naught times a naught over 4 LP squared. And beta naught will depend on pi square root of 3, 2, and so on and so forth. And this is one configuration. Now you have to do this for all configurations that are consistent with all these constraints. And when you do this, you get, I don't know. Do you remember the value, Jurek? I don't remember this. It's given, so it's very complicated. All possible spins contributions are there. I mean, it's not just this one half contribution, which is the dominant one, but there are others which are not negligible. And I think the beta naught is the solution to the transcendental equation. Equation sum 1 is equal to 2 times sum k is equal to 1 to infinity e to the minus, I don't know, 8 pi or something, beta naught square root of k times k plus 1. So and this the sum from 1 to infinity corresponds to the fact that in principle you have to take into account all possible spins, not only spin 1 half. So and then there are also the subleading terms, logarithmic corrections. So that's basically it. I mean, up to these defined details, of course, as far as the entropy counting is concerned. And the philosophy is that you choose the Mirzi parameter, which is a parameter that you cannot fix in the theory a priori. You fix it such that this is equal to beta is equal to beta naught. And this, of course, would be nonsense if it wouldn't work for all possible interesting black holes. So as far as I know, all black holes in the Kerr, Nordström, Schwarzschild family can be assigned the same beta naught. And you can also put Dilatonic and Young-Mills hair on the black hole. And it works for the same parameter. This result here is rather recent. It has been studied by Jurek and one of his students, Domogala. So what they did, they discovered that actually, in the beginning, people thought that there was a calculation mistake in the literature, which somehow boiled down to the fact that only spin 1 half can be counted, and all the other contributions only give logarithmic corrections. That turned out to be wrong. And then Jurek and his student discovered that this is not the case, and there are more contributions. And they gave upper and lower bounds for this beta naught. And then Christoph Meissner actually discovered this value. And maybe this should be called beta naught equal to beta m, the Meissner Mirzi parameter. OK. So I want to stop here with the black holes and show you something on the computer. So we need the screen.
You want to do it yourself?
I don't know how to do it.
Do it.
Let's see whether this works, because Windows says it has an error. No, it's not internet. Okay, it seems to work. So this, what we are going to see now, is an animation of the dynamics of loop quantum gravity. And what we will see is a graph, a colored graph, or rather the dual of a colored graph. So these are tetrahedra now, which correspond to a dual graph, dual to a four-valent graph. And the colors on these triangles, they denote the spin quantum numbers. Red stands for low, and blue stands for high spin. And the this animation, this is not a simulation, it's an animation meant for dragging money from taxpayers. is supposed to illustrate how the quantum geometry changes in the course of time. So you see that there are some tetrahedrons which are disappearing, some of them are growing, and also when we fly through this structure, through this crystal, you see that in the background also the colors change, like the spins change when we act with a holonomy operator, for example. Well, and then you see this void area regions here. This is not vacuum, or that means matter-free regions. This is just a hole in space-time. There's nothing. There's not even geometry. So you see that also there's some kind of topology change all over the place here. This film was created during 2005, which was the Einstein year. And our institute was able to drag 80,000 euros in order to create this film, and 16 Pentium 3 processors were working for 1 week on this. So it's kind of a difficult thing. So thank you very much for your attention, and also for your endurance, because I know this was not easy. Thank you very much.